Welcome to the 11th episode of Hike Club. Today I am joined by a very special guest in his own lair in Hammersmith. It is producer, writer, all-round badass extraordinaire, Lewis Thompson. Hello.
Hello. This is great because 11 is my lucky number.
Is it?
Yep, it is.
The Chinese, I think, have an unlucky number, which is, I think it's 8. Have you heard about this?
No.
In certain hotels, well, in all the hotels in China, there is no floor 8.
Oh, really?
So apparently this is a thing. Like, we don't... What's our unlucky number? 13.
13, isn't it?
Yeah. Here, yeah. So... do you have an unlucky number? Have you got an unlucky number?
Ooh, I don't. All the numbers are good for me.
All the numbers are good for you. Why is 11 your lucky number?
It was my dad's football shirt.
Okay.
And it was then therefore my football shirt.
Okay. But
unfortunately, I wasn't very good at football.
You weren't very good at football.
So it didn't make any difference anyway.
You do play in a five-a-side team, right?
I do, yeah. But again, not very good. Punctual.
Punctual, shout out, John and Will. I'm seeing them later.
Yeah.
We met, I think, about 2016 or something like
that. Yeah, I think so. And that's actually a long time ago, isn't it?
Yeah. A long time ago. What were you doing then? And this has been a long journey
from then. Yeah, kind of chapter three, I reckon, out of all my musical chapters. Yeah, I was mainly, I hadn't really worked out how to write songs yet, hence why you came in and helped me.
Okay.
But we met, 2016, and we were working on Just Kidding, which was a project that I started. It's the kind of first musical project that I started, and we were working on that together. I think we did our first session. Was it in Brighton?
It was either at my place in St Albans.
It was. Yeah. I remember in the shed.
Yeah, in the shed, in the back room. And you know what, that back room is so funny because maybe we'll talk about this in a bit, but sort of where you create music and create inspiration and stuff, it's like, it's a small place, but so many big things have come from there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of taught me it doesn't really matter where you are.
It's actually better to just have somewhere you can access quickly and just get your ideas down quickly, I think.
Yeah.
Even for me now, this 15-minute cycle to here, which is dreamy for London, is a little bit stifling creatively, like a tiny bit. I find I've had to have a setup at home. Like, for the first 6 months, I was just coming here, and then I had to build a setup at home so that when that inspiration comes, you've got somewhere to go, right, I'm getting it down now.
We were in a really nice studio when we worked in Brighton.
We were, yeah. We were in this sort of like luxury LA kind of style house.
It was ridiculous.
It was insane. Yeah. We made a couple of great tunes then, but I think at that point in my journey, I hadn't really worked out that you could write songs and just write them for pitch and kind of pitch songs. It was all like, oh, it has to be for my project, which is Just Kidding. So I was kind of always going into the room as an artist, and that mindset is actually quite limiting. If you're constantly going, I need to write for this project, it needs to fit into this box, it's quite limiting, not just for you but for everybody else in the room. And like, one thing that I learned is when you kind of open those doors and that limitations, you write better songs. And you'll end up writing better songs for your project as well, because you'll do something different.
Sure.
So,
And your project was, how would you describe it? It was sort of in the dance lane.
Yeah, it was dance. Yeah, it was like, and I'm still doing that. It was like the best thing that could ever happen to me, because that project showed me that I could have a career in music. I mean, before I was doing that, I was a man in a suit in an office job doing that sort of stuff.
What were you doing?
I had a few jobs.
Setting microwaves or something.
Not far. Pretty much. I finished uni, and then I got a degree in business. And then thought, right, I'll go and get a business job then.
Yeah.
Got a job. I got a couple of jobs, but the second job I had was selling computers. Pretty much, like laptops and computers and stuff like that. I was doing the marketing.
He's saying this with a slight grin, so I'm not sure. Like, I'm getting images of him selling them out of a back of a white van somewhere on the King's Road or something. You know?
It was quite the opposite. It was very, very corporate. I was like a man in a suit every day. Looking back, it was probably one of the best things that happened to me. I knew I wanted to do music, and basically being at this office job pushed me so much harder, because I thought, if this is the rest of my life, like, I literally remember the first day joining, there was this like guy who head up and he was like, welcome to the first day of the rest of your life. And I was like, yeah, fuck, okay, this probably is, isn't it? And it is for like 95% of people. But I used how frustrated I was feeling at work to kind of go, right, weekends, evenings, you've got to get out of this. I wrote down, I took it really seriously. I remember writing down goals of like, if you can earn £250 a month from making music, then you can go 4 days a week.
Wow. Super still serious.
Got, yeah, I've still got it. I've got it in this app that I've got. I've still got all the notes. And then I remember like, okay, now if you can earn £400 a month, you can go 3 days a week, because that'll be like, I was living with my parents, I didn't even need that much money, to be honest, but I was like, I just wanted to kind of use those kind of goals to get out of this situation I was in. And then one day I walked into the office and they took all of the people in our department, there was like 100 people, so it was a big company, upstairs, and they said, right, we're moving all of the marketing department to Budapest. Does anyone want to move to Budapest? And no one put their hands up. So they're like, sorry, all of you have lost your jobs. I was at the back of the room like going like, yes,
kid. You're the only one celebrating.
Yeah, I was like set, like obviously try not to, obviously I felt bad, there was people there with families.
Yeah.
I felt bad, there's people there with,
we've lost our jobs.
Lost our jobs.
Yeah, woo.
It was proper, I don't know if you've seen that film Office Space, it's one of my favorite films. No. But it was that sort of vibe. But then they took me to the side after the meeting and they said, oh, we're keeping 5 jobs here and we want you to take one of them, and it's going to be this massive promotion, you're going to get a car, all this. And I was like, oh, I felt so guilty. They really like saw like a future in me in this thing, and I didn't really see it. I went home and spoke to my parents and they were like, oh, brilliant, well done. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna go in tomorrow and tell them I don't want to do it. And they're like, what are you gonna do then? I was like, I'm gonna go and tell them I'm gonna do music. I mean, my parents have always been really supportive, but I think then they were thinking, you're a bit mental.
Yeah.
And I went in the office the next day, just said, I don't want to do this, I've got a track that's going to be signed on a sub-label of Ministry of Sound, and I think I can do music. And to be fair, they were really sound, but it got word got out in the office, and I think everyone in the office thought I was a complete lunatic.
Yeah.
But that was the best decision I ever made.
I think life comes down to those really critical decision points sometimes, doesn't it? Where
for sure.
It can go one way or the other. And
for sure.
But it's one of those things where you're standing at the threshold thinking, okay, if I go left, if I carry on with this job, okay, I get a car, like I get security. But you were probably, and this is, I think, the same with a lot of other musicians. Everyone has different stories, but whereby you're presented with this challenge to yourself. It's like, okay, I can have security for a long period of my life. If there's any such thing these days. Or I can have risk, excitement, enjoyment, but the rewards are so much higher. So you made the decision to go in the next day and say, I'm sorry, I'm quitting. What did life look like the next few weeks and months for you?
Well, it was really nice, because I was just suddenly like, oh my God, I can actually, rather than just kind of when I'm knackered, like kind of putting some songs together, I can actually like spend all day on it. Instantly, the productivity went upwards. And then probably about a couple of months after that, I made a song with Laurie called Thinking About It, which, well, looking back, that's still a really special song to me, because it was like our first kind of break into kind of the pop dance space. And it was kind of my first realization of like, holy shit, like a song can do so much for you. Like I did 2 tours of America off this like record. Laurie was working in Las Iguanas at the time in a Latin American restaurant. Yeah. And we're getting on a plane to New York, and honestly, it was some of the best memories I've had, because it was just me and my best friend traveling America, like going to shows every night, thinking, how the fuck is this happening? I kind of had the taste of what life would be like without music.
Yeah.
And I just thought
to myself,
it didn't
taste good.
It didn't taste good.
And I think for a lot of people that we've had on the podcast so far and other interviews I listened to, you can't imagine doing anything else, and everything else that you could imagine doing, if that's a kind of a contradiction in itself, is dreadful.
Yeah.
And I always said that, like, if I had an office job, I'd be sacked within a week, because I'd say something.
I think I'd say something.
Or I'd like give my opinion where it wasn't wanted.
Hope there's not any mic checks.
No, quite. The Just Kidding thing kind of morphed into writing for other people that you were talking about earlier. So how did that transition happen?
Oh, that is weird. I'd been doing Just Kidding for about 5 years. So I'd been doing 5 years of back-to-back sessions, you know, going to London twice a week, writing songs. That process of doing that kind of gave me the kind of knowledge of how sessions work. You know, you figure out dynamics in the room and how things work. And then I moved up to Leeds, and I'd done a few sessions with Rob Harvey before in London, and he was actually the only person I knew when I moved up there. So I actually just hit him up as in, like, do you want to hang out? We were both at quite similar points in our career where I was doing Just Kidding. It was doing all right. But, like, I was not secure at all, like, financially or anything. Like, I wasn't secure at all. I think at the time I'd just been dropped from my first management as well. He was at a point where he was doing PT, actually. He was being a PT.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, do you remember that? Yeah. So, and we were sort of both at this kind of crossroads in our lives. We were like, should we just get in and see what happens? Should we just get in? And I was like, yeah, but what do you want to write for? Like, he was like, let's just write. And that, even that was weird to me. I was like, well, what waste of, this is going to be a complete waste of time. But it wasn't. And we'd get in touch with people and try and find singers to come and work with us. And luckily there was quite a few good people in Leeds at the time. We just got in and wrote kind of pop records. And that process for me, looking back, was amazing because I was with Rob, who is a very incredible songwriter. And I didn't realise at the time, but I was actually learning. He was teaching me so much. And I think I was actually, without realising as well, I was actually teaching him so much. And we were working together and building this really strong relationship and good foundation on how to make songs. And I kind of was like, you're actually all right at doing this pop stuff. Like, you can kind of do that as well. I thought I could just do dance, but I was like, maybe I could do some of the pop stuff. And I quite enjoyed just doing that for a bit. That, looking back, was so valuable for me because I do think I learned a lot about songwriting in that process. And then from there, I mean, we actually had a couple of little cuts here and there. We had like a cut for Afrojack. I got a new management and speaking to certain A&Rs, and everyone was like, oh, you need to be in London. When someone tells me I need to do something, I do the opposite.
The always. Rebel spirit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what got you into music in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to come work for us. You need a car. You need all this, yeah, you know.
That's so true. So when they said that, I was like, no, I'm going to just do it from here. I think we've got something good going here. Like, I want to just keep working on this. And we met Harley. We wrote a song and I remember just being like blown away by how good she was. And then we had this bank of records and we had a few little cuts. And then I got put in touch with Joel Corry, yeah.
Not everyone's on first name terms with the stars like you are, so.
Well, back then it was really surreal because I remember getting a DM from him and I looked and I thought, I recognise that guy, and I'd watch Geordie Shore.
Okay.
Growing up, I've got family from Newcastle, so I wanted to watch it. And he came to my house, and we actually just really, really got on. He's a lovely guy, and we got on really well. And we just started making tunes together. I didn't really think anything was ever going to happen with it. I actually just really liked Joel and liked hanging out with him, and we were good friends. He had this idea one day to cover Monster Boy, Sorry.
This was a huge garage tune, UK garage tune, I think about 2000, 2001, something like that, maybe.
Probably. Around that time. Might have even been later, because I remember when I was at uni, it was that would have been about 2006, 2007 or something.
It's earlier than that. It was already a big hit, and it was a big part of Pirate Radio culture. I used to listen to Pirate Radio as a kid, and I used to hear that on Pirate Radio. So you'd taken this song, and why did you take that song? He had the
Joel,
idea. Right?
Joel had the idea. Right. It's one of those ones that's really popular, but never like peaked or like fully like hit the kind of commercial market, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I never thought of it like that. I just thought that's actually a wicked idea. Mm. I'd been working with Hayley May quite a lot. I'd been working with her for years, to be fair. She's brilliant, and we always really got on. Because it was a cover, we didn't really need to write anything. We changed a couple of lyrics. But honestly, I'm not joking when I say this. Like, the song and the session was done in 45 minutes.
Wow.
It was one of those where, like, it almost felt like all of the fiddling around with sounds and chords and everything for the last 10 years kind of just went and fell into place. Like, oh, I wonder if this sound will work. Boom. Oh, yeah, it does. Yeah. Oh, I wonder what about this bass line. Oh, yeah, it does. Oh, and then it was like, oh, I had like my favorite kick drums, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Dragged it all in. It's like, oh, yeah, it all kind of works. The record came out and it was, I think it was 6 in the charts.
So that's your first top 10 record?
That was my first top any record.
Top any record.
Top anything. Anything. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think amazing. Actually, I think one of the Just Kidding ones went in at like 70. I went and DJed with Joel in Greece and we were just sitting there eating breakfast and he was like, it's just gone number 6. I just never, ever thought that we would be sitting there and that would happen.
So you helped launch each other in a way in terms of the music, because obviously he was a TV star. And I guess because you'd built up this relationship together creatively and personally, and you're hanging out and you're DJing and you're celebrating breakfast together. So you had a top 10, which was, I mean, and they're hard to come by and it's not easy to have one. Like you say, 45 minutes actually. Behind that, there were years and work and trial and error and everything. So we want to get to your billion stream plus hit Head and Heart. Yeah. How did that come about? Usually I don't ask people about that stuff, but it's kind of such a huge trajectory from The Office, having a top six, top 10, and then going straight to, what was that like?
Okay.
And how did that come about? And was that an older song that you'd done, or?
Like I said, me and Rob had been writing together. We had this sort of bank of songs.
Yep.
Joel randomly picked out Lonely. That came out. That went to number 3.
Of course, I forgot about that. We don't want to skip past any more success, but
yeah. But it was more just to kind of show the process of how these songs were kind of come in, and we were like, "Oh, what about this?" And it was just a chorus. "What about this chorus? Do you like it?" "Yeah, yeah, I do. Let's work on it." We developed it.
Yep.
And then it came out.
Amazing.
And then Head and Heart was the same, but I didn't start that process. Rob started it with Dan Dare and Johnny from Kaleidoscopes, and they came up to Leeds. From what I understand, Dan and John had the incredible melody, which apparently John wrote on the toilet.
Yeah.
And they were like, "Oh, we've got this melody. Like, what do you think?" They kind of did a bass line that followed it. And then Rob was like, "Yeah, let's just like try and contextualize that. So what about if in the verses, it's my head talking and all these things happening, and then the chorus is literally like, that is the sound of your heart." It's quite simple, like probably has been done before maybe,
yeah,
but like, yeah. I thought that was like a really key part of it. Cause you like,
yeah,
as we all know, like having a melody is one thing, but then like contextualizing it is quite challenging.
Sure.
So then that was how that kind of formed together. And then Rob sent it to Joel and me, and we were like, "This is amazing." And then me and Neve worked on the production with Joel to kind of fill it out and turn it into something else. We sent it to M&EK, and he kind of just took it up another level, added a pre-chorus, added a middle eight, just does what M&EK does, which is, everyone knows, is amazing. It was another one that felt quite easy, to be honest. I mean, it really helps when you've got, firstly, like an insanely catchy melody, which Dan and John had.
That's quite interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the post melody the same as the verse melody?
Yeah, it's all the same.
It's all the same. And then the pre-chorus, which is
slight departure
with Max Martin, take it away somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then you go back to that undeniable thing. And it's like, if you've got something good, use it and use it again.
I think that's a good philosophy for songwriting. Like, definitely something I've learned. And I get a lot of people sending me songs now and being like, "Oh, what do you think to this?" And I'd say 90% of what I'm thinking is when I'm hearing these songs is just too complicated. There's too much lyric. There's too much melody. There's too many rhythms. One thing that I really try and do is just try and make the song, the top line and the production, as simple as possible. So you've got a lot of things that mirror each other. There's tags that mirror each other. There's bits of chorus melody, the rhythms that are actually in the verses that sit there, but you don't realise it, but they're sort of subtly hinting at it. The best songs do that, right? Like, even I remember Rob showing me Whitney Houston, "How Will I Know," and just being like, "Listen to the chords, it's the chorus."
That's true.
And I remember just being like, "Oh my god," because I'd always come at songwriting from like it's got to be kind of interesting and complicated, but actually, nah, you're wrong.
I was watching Rick Beato talk about Tina Turner doing a tribute to Tina Turner, who's obviously sadly passed away, and they're talking about the song "The Best." Rick was talking about the little things I think are probably ignored or maybe not emphasised enough in modern songwriting. So again, I'm not going to, obviously I can sing a little bit, but I don't want to do this on the podcast, because you know when you just like, you imitate singing and it sounds like you can't sing, but there's a bit where you go, "Simply the best," and then the music goes dang, 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 and that bit is as much of a hook.
It is.
Like Head and Heart having that melodic thing that goes everywhere. And also as well, being able to recognise, okay, there's something great in there, let's just help make it better, let's help boost the production, let's help make these ideas as big as they can be.
Totally.
That's something, that's a real skill as well, not to get in the way of it, because you could have come in and said, chop the bits around or something, or said, "No, go back and rewrite the verse," you know? But I think it's such a skill to be able to hear that and go, "Wow, that's amazing, don't fuck with it."
Yeah.
You know,
and that's what production is, I think. In pop production, it's, here's the song, let's emphasize this song and make it as good as possible.
You recently did the UK's Eurovision entry. Well, I want to talk about
that was coming.
I have to talk about that, because that is, like, there are some sort of stepping stones in musical careers, you know, like film music or TV placements or whatever. Eurovision is one of those, like, weird, like, Pandora's boxes of, like, what on earth are we doing here?
But totally.
How, I mean, I know you've explained in other interviews how that came about, but what were your initial thoughts when the idea of Eurovision came up?
May came in, and it had been a session that actually got cancelled twice, and I think maybe both times was actually my fault.
Sounds about right. I'm joking. Lewis is one of the most reliable people actually in the music business. Texted him last night. I was like, "Are you still doing this podcast?"
Yeah, I mean, I do need to speak to you about Friday.
Friday.
We've got a session on Friday that I can't do anymore.
There you go. Like I say, Lewis is one of the most unreliable people in music, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
She came in. Session got cancelled like a couple times, so it's probably 2 months later than what it should have been. She came in like, "So what are we writing for today then, May?" I really liked her straight away. She's like, "Well, my album's done, you know, I'm not really looking for any songs on that anymore." And I kind of looked at Kaz and looked at May, and I was like, "Well, don't really know what we're doing here then, but let's just mess about. Maybe we'll make a song." I think actually that was really important as well, because I think it was almost like, okay, well, we're not really writing for you then, you know, let's just write a song for Pitch. And that was also really unique. That feeling is, from an artistic point of view, is really interesting, I think, because it takes the pressure off the artist to feel like they are getting something that they need for their project.
Sure.
She came in with kind of like the title, and she had a melody. And interestingly, this is kind of interesting, back to what we were talking about earlier. I remember in the session doing the obvious thing of like, and I thought, right, well, she sung this thing. I was like, right, that's the bass line then. Yeah. That's going to be the bass. Like, that has to be that in the chord. So I started making these chords that followed that.
Yeah.
And it was working, but for some reason, there was just some part of me that thought, let's not do that this time. Let's just not do that. Let's not do the classic thing and do some other chords and mess about. And it worked so much better. Sometimes you can flip it on its head, because it was, I was like, that is such a good melody. Let's just drill that home. But who knows, maybe if I'd done that, it would have been a number one.
Maybe
I cocked it up.
It did pretty well. I mean, I have the stats in my brain because I'm a stats man. If I ever had a superhero persona, I would be stats man. I was only good at giving you stats. I keep spreadsheets of all my airplay statistics and everything just like that. So
That doesn't surprise me.
I'm the only person I know who does that. But it was a number one airplay in the UK. It's been number one airplay.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
So
yeah.
It's, and to be honest,
it was also 25th finisher in the Eurovision.
So this is a really weird concept, right? You have a song that's the Eurovision entry, and very fortuitously in the country that's hosting
the
contest. Now, I actually heard a statistic when I was watching the Eurovision. Apparently, that actually really goes against the country.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so apparently no one who's hosted it has
won it.
Or something.
Yeah.
That might, like one person or something, because it's usually really, really bad. But the interesting thing is, you have what could be considered, and I'm going to use the tabloid thing here, a failure in terms of the positioning. But then you also have this really weird, unique set of circumstances where it's basically doing really well. Like, it's number one airplay in like one of the biggest music markets in the world.
Mm.
It's done really well in the charts.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone likes the song, apart from the fact that it's a Eurovision. You know, you can't make people like a song, even if it's a Eurovision song.
Mm.
But what is that like, to go looking at the charts and go, well, hang on a second, it's doing really well, but then we've come second to last in Eurovision. What? How does your brain deal with? How does your head and heart deal with that?
There you go. We went to Eurovision.
Were you there? Because we didn't see you on TV.
No, I was hidden in the.
You were hidden.
Yeah, I was hidden in the crowd.
Okay.
But yeah, I was in the crowd watching it. I'm competitive. You're competitive. Like, we want to do well at things. Mm. I went into it thinking, I don't know, there was a little part of my brain that was like, maybe we'll win. Maybe, you know, it's in Liverpool, it's in England. I'm not a massive follower of Eurovision. I didn't really know that the host country's at a massive disadvantage. Maybe we'll get top five. Maybe we'll get top 10. I watched everyone. And like, there was actually some really good entries in there. But I thought, we're definitely getting top half. Like, surely. That, like, the song went down so well.
Mm.
And then, you know, you get the countries come in and it's sort of, you know, Spain, nil pois, France, nil pois. You're like, okay, kind of expected that.
Yeah.
Australia, you're like, come on. Yeah. Australia are going to do, you know, they like us. It's nothing. Denmark, I've got loads of Danish friends. They all love British. Like, nah, nothing.
Often the votes have been political, but last year changed the perception of that. Mm. And obviously we've been helping Ukraine loads, and Sam Ryder did a brilliant job and everything. Mm. We came second, obviously Ukraine deservedly won, but it almost like that curse, I felt that curse had been lifted off our country.
Same, that's it.
And then you come and you bring the curse back onto the UK.
I know.
But so,
know.
Yeah, you're saying you're looking at the results.
But we're sitting in the audience. I'm sitting next to Karen.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel good. it doesn't feel good because you're sitting there, there's, you know, you're in an arena of thousands of people and you're seeing, oh no, they didn't vote any for us. And I'm looking at Kaz thinking, we're going to be bottom here. And I can see her, she was even worse than me. She's like, oh my God, this is so bad. My main sort of thinking was actually, oh my God, I feel terrible for May. Before she said she was going to do it, we found out that I don't think she was, but maybe her management or someone around her was a little bit nervous about her entering and wasn't sure if it was the best thing to do. I actually think she's got a really bright future ahead of her. And I was just thought, maybe this isn't going to help it. Finishing last in Eurovision, but actually kind of did the opposite.
I watched the whole show and I was rating them with my own personal rating system the whole time. I was with a friend who's...
I bet that was in the spreadsheet as well.
That was in the spreadsheet as well. But we were rating them together and I was doing it. And I was coming at it from a songwriter's perspective. And obviously I'm coming at it with a high standard. Yeah. So when I was watching it, you know, your song was actually a song, a proper song. And there were so many other weird random novelty things that weren't even they weren't even good enough to sustain the novelty for 2 minutes or however long the song's supposed to be. And the fact is, had it been, I guess, like a novelty record or something, or like objectively bad as a song, then that would have been a different thing. I used to work at a music production songwriting house, and the head producer there, who's very, very successful, he told me the one thing about success and failure, if you get caught out making a bad record, and you, because I once came in on one Monday after one of their songs they put out had kind of flopped, and he said, we didn't get caught out putting a bad record, and if that, and at least you can hold your head up high and say that. And with you guys, what happened was, you know, you got caught out putting a good record out, you know? It's just you're just victim of the whims of whatever, you know what I mean? It's like maybe the placement in the day and the running order was different, who knows, you know, come down to the performance of the day, I don't know what it is. If we didn't be Brexit, of course, there's all sorts of things, you know. So it's not always within your control.
That's so true about a bad record. I also think you can have bad hits.
Oh, for sure.
Like put out a song that you're not 100% sure about as an artist, and even if it's a hit and you don't like it, it can stifle you. Mm. It's not all hits are
created equal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really think, because I'm an artist now as well, which I have been always, but like now I'm doing it under my name and stuff, and I've really had to kind of figure out why I make music, kind of really like hone in on what I'm actually doing, because there's been moments in this artistic journey where I've been asked to do things that I'm not sure about. The reason why I make music is for me. It's because I like putting out songs that I like. And if I start putting out songs that I don't like, what the hell am I doing it for? I'm not doing it for money. If I was doing it for money, I would have kept the office job. I would have been driving around in a company car for years now. Yeah,
of course.
That's a really key thing, is like, make sure when you're making music for yourself, make sure you like it.
And because you've had so much success with a range of different artists, more than Joel, more than May, we could get into this, but take too long. But when it comes to your own music, it's almost worse because you're like, well, I've had all this success with other people. People then are going to be judging me on my thing, but I don't need this vehicle to make me money.
No,
it'd be great if it did, and obviously leading to gigs and another avenue of and more control essentially over songs and more avenues for your songs to come up. So obviously essentially that is the goal, I guess, but to start from a place of, this has to make me money, this has to come out cynically,
it's not that. I'm not doing that as project for that. I'm doing it to satisfy my taste in making songs.
Tina Turner said, I watched one of her last interviews, and she said, I think it was Letterman or someone asked her, do you have to like everything? She said, oh yes, have to like everything. And then he said, is there anything you've put out you didn't like? And she said, what's love got to do with it? And that's her biggest hit. Which is really funny. She said, I didn't like it. And she said, but I was kind of convinced to do it. And so I sort of did. And she said, I found a way to make it work. And now live, I find a way to make it work. But isn't that interesting? It's her biggest thing.
Wow.
And she didn't like it.
I mean, in dance music, that's so common. I mean,
revealing some trade secrets here.
Well, I just know so many big DJs down the years, like apparently Eric Prydz doesn't play piano, and these big DJs, they're almost ashamed to have commercial success, and they don't want to play their records.
Do you think, but because especially, I mean, the UK has such a long history of dance music always clashing with pop music and always being part of the pop music kind of genre.
Does, yeah.
So do you think, because you've been around both worlds, and obviously you're commercially inclined in the way you write music anyway, do you think that is, because there'll always be an underground and things will always get saturated and move back underground again, and new things will rise up and new genres will come out and stuff.
True.
Do you think, as a professional dance and pop music producer, songwriter, Do you think that shame has gone away a bit more? Or do you think there's still a thing of a DJ going, oh, I'm signed to a label here where we've got a JV with a big label. We need to make a hit and we're not that excited about it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because you know a lot of the DJs who are arriving.
I think it's gone away a little bit. And I actually think currently right now, like pop music is more, like dance pop music is way more underground than it has been maybe in like 5 or 6 years, I think.
In what way?
Well, like records that, the two biggest records last year were LF System and Eliza Rose. They're both number ones, weren't they? And they're not like commercial, in some ways, they're not like commercial inverted commas records, are they? They're kind of dance records that you could play in a club.
There's something about, I think, the LF record and the Eliza Rose record where it's almost like the way they were made was not in the way of knowing how to write a hit.
No.
Or how to make, the LF thing was a sample, but the way they processed it was really unique, especially with the speed thing
and
everything.
Speed thing, yeah.
Those are the ones, I think, that really break through and make a cultural impact. So how are you able, or are you even able to get back to that place of naivety whereby you can just let loose and try something new without fear of failure? Or because it's hard for me to do, to try and get back to that thing where,
to
like,
that kind of, it's that like almost childlike kind of approach to making music again,
well, you're not
it?
Trying to write a hit, and you're not trying to, you almost have to unlearn everything you've learned, kind of thing. But is that even possible? Are you too far gone?
Has the formula taken over my body yet?
Yeah. I mean, is it, are you too poisoned?
Am I too poisoned? I don't think so. I think you can do it as well. It's like we kind of did it with Fever, really. Mm. That was like against a lot of the rules.
We have a song out.
Yeah.
And I was driving to home base the other day. And I was texting you, actually, 9:30 in the morning to buy Weed Killer. And I tell you what, man, if you get a garden, you will be forever picking the bloody weeds out of that thing. Yeah. I tell you, but I turned the radio on at 9:30 in the morning, just driving, like a little drive to the shop, and our song is on. And your name's flashing across the screen or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, that almost has the feeling of like naivety again. Like,
yeah,
I always wanted to hear my voice on the radio, you know?
Yeah.
And to hear something I'd done with my mates just be on the radio. You know, I never managed it with my band or anything. And yet here we are, you know.
And you sounded great on it. You sound amazing.
And I had so many questions and people going, man, is that like Michael Jackson AI or something? Or how did you do that? And I'm like,
really?
we just did something, slowed it down, sped it up. You guys added all the amazing bits to it and made it sound like a proper record in the end. What is the weirdest place you've heard your music?
Do you know what? This is really random. I went to Colombia backpacking about 3 years ago, and we were in this little remote hostel in this mountain, in these Colombian mountains. It's called, this area called Minca, and like, honestly, it's like dirt tracks everywhere. And that we were in this hostel, only Spanish people speaking. In reception, they were playing music. They were just like literally playing their Spotify or whatever, and they were playing one of my Just Kidding tunes in this like remote little mountain resort, and I was with all my friends. And they were like, oh yeah, this is your song. And I thought, that is mental. Like, you can't even get milk here.
Wow.
What the hell? They're playing my tunes.
And you go back to what we said at the beginning of choosing between one pathway and one other pathway. And you could have been in Bucharest, or you could have taken that extra job, you know, and had the company car.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be here now, and you'd never have those stories, you know.
Like you said earlier, there's loads of little steps down the way that you kind of make. They feel like mad decisions at the time, but those things really shape you. Like, even how I started getting into DJing, I completely blagged it. I went to a club night at uni, met a promoter, and he said, Arnie, I'm looking for a DJ. I don't know if you know any DJs. And I was drunk, and I told him I could DJ. I told him I was a really good DJ. And he's like, oh, wicked, like, I've been looking for someone, blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, I've been doing it for years, blah, blah, blah. Complete lie, complete bollocks. The next morning, he texts me saying, you ready to come down tonight? Like we spoke about last night, just set times at night.
Oops.
Yeah, literally, like, at the time, I was very, you know, I could so easily just never reply to the guy.
Yeah.
Just, you know,
just
never replied to him. It was a stupid thing to lie. I thought to myself, you idiot, Lewis, like, what are you doing? But I didn't. I went to Morrison's, bought 50 pack of CDs, burnt off loads of records that I had. They weren't even like dance tunes or anything. They were just random tunes.
Yeah.
Watched a YouTube video, because I remember seeing this Pioneer. I remember seeing Pioneer everywhere. Watched a YouTube video and went, and it was probably shocking.
Yeah.
But went and did it, and he gave me like he was like, oh, cool, you can come back next week.
Wow. And that's it.
Yeah, so now like, I look back on that. That was another like big kind of turning point, because that changed everything for me.
Yeah.
And then so did not taking this job. And if you think you're making the wrong decision, but it's like something that inside feels right, just do it.
Make it happen.
Yeah.
Speaking of making it happen, what's the sort of the next year hold for you? Do you make any future plans, or are you sort of...
I don't make too many. Like, I don't think about it too much, because I know that the last few years have been a complete roller coaster for me, and I know that at some point I'm going to need to sit and be like, this is pretty mad what you're doing. I've had success and stuff, but internally, like, it doesn't feel right. I don't feel like I get very severe imposter syndrome.
Mm-mm.
Like, I feel like I was never actually meant to be here in some ways, because I'm like not a trained musician. I've never really, you know, I played guitar when I was younger, but never had a music lesson in my life. I've spoke to a lot of creatives about this, and everyone has imposter syndrome.
For sure.
But I do feel like at some point I need to take a bit of a stock and be kind of sit down and just be like, wow, that was pretty mad. But at the moment, I'm still kind of in the race. My only plan is to focus on making the best music I possibly can. And I really kind of want to put a bit more attention towards my artist project now. I've got a record that's out right now with Becky Hill, and it's my first top 40 as a solo artist.
Congrats.
Thanks, man. It feels good to actually see my name on the tune and out with Becky. And I really like the songs. Suddenly feel a little bit more pressure to kind of nail that and... Which I should feel is healthy, and I kind of want to focus on getting that in shape.
Well, on that very inspiring and successful happy note, I'd like to thank you so much. It's been really inspiring listening to your journey from the office to Eurovision to space and beyond, and all the Colombian hotel receptions in between.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's been Hike Club, Lewis Thompson.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hike Club.